"You mean we've got to go on that?" he said. Koyisadra looked at him scornfully, the point of Kring still aimed at his neck.
"How else would anyone get to the Wyrmberg?"
"I don't know," said Rincewind. "How else?"
"I mean there is no other way. It's flying or nothing."
Rincewind looked again at the dragon before him. He could quite clearly see through it to the crushed grass on which it lay, but when he gingerly touched a scale that was a mere golden sheen on thin air, it felt solid enough. Either dragons should exist completely, or fail to exist at all, he felt. A dragon only half existing was worse than the extremes. "I didn't know dragons could be seen through," he said. Koyisadra shrugged.
"Didn't you?"
he said. He swung himself astride the dragon awkwardly, because Rincewind was hanging onto his belt. Once uncomfortably aboard, the wizard moved his white-knuckle grip to a convenient piece of harness and prodded Koyisadra lightly with the sword.
"Have you ever flown before?"
said the dragon rider without looking round.
"Not as such, no."
"Would you like something to suck?"
Rincewind gazed at the back of the man's head, then dropped to the bag of red and yellow sweet that was being proffered.
"Is it necessary?" he asked.
"It is traditional," said Koyisadra. "Please yourself."
The dragon stood up, lumbered heavily across the meadow, and fluttered into the air. Rincewind occasionally had nightmares about teetering on some intangible but enormously high place, and seeing a blue-distanced, cloud-punctuated landscape reeling away below him. This usually woke him up with his ankles sweating. He would have been even more worried had he known that the nightmare was not, as he thought, just the usual Discworld vertigo. It was a backwards memory of an event in his future so terrifying that it had generated harmonics of fear all the way along his lifeline. This was not that event, but it was good practice for it. Psepha clawed its way into the air with a series of vertebra-shattering bounds. At the top of its last leap, the wide wings unfolded with a snap and spread out with a thump which shook the trees. Then the ground was gone. Dropping away in a series of gentle jerks, Psepha was suddenly rising gracefully, the afternoon sunlight gleaming off wings that were still no more than a golden film. Rincewind made the mistake of glancing downwards and found himself looking through the dragon to the treetops below. Far below. His stomach shrank at the sight. Closing his eyes wasn't much better because it gave his imagination full rein. He compromised by gazing fixedly into the middle distance, where moorland and forest drifted by and could be contemplated almost casually. Wind snatched at him. Koyisadra half turned and shouted into his ear,
"Behold, the Wyrmberg!"
Rincewind turned his head slowly, taking care to keep Kring resting lightly on the dragon's back. His streaming eyes saw the impossibly inverted mountain rearing out of the deep forested valley like a trumpet in a tub of moss. Even at this distance, he could make out the faint octarine glow in the air that must be indicating a stable magic aura of at least, he gasped, several milliprime, at least.
"Oh, no," he said.
Even looking at the ground was better than that. He averted his eyes quickly and realized that he could now no longer see the ground through the dragon. As they glided around in a wide circle towards the Wyrmberg, it was definitely taking on a more solid form, as if the creature's body was filling with a gold mist. By the time the Wyrmberg was in front of them, swinging wildly across the sky, the dragon was as real as a rock. Rincewind thought he could see a faint streak in the air, as if something from the mountain had reached out and touched the beast. He got the strange feeling that the dragon was being made more genuine. Ahead of it, the Wyrmberg turned from a distant toy to several billion tons of rock poised between heaven and earth. He could see small fields, woods, and a lake up there, and from the lake a river spilled out and over the edge. He made the mistake of following the thread of foaming water with his eyes, and jerked himself back just in time. The flared plateau of the upturned mountain drifted towards them. The dragon didn't even slow. As the mountain loomed over Rincewind like the biggest fly-swatter in the universe, he saw a cave mouth. Psepha skimmed towards it, shoulder muscles pumping. The wizard screamed as the dark spread and enfolded him. There was a brief vision of rock flashing past, blurred by speed. Then the dragon was in the open again. It was inside a cave, but bigger than any cave had a right to be. The dragon, gliding across its vast emptiness, was a mere gilded fly in a banqueting hall. There were other dragons, gold, silver, black, white, flapping across the sun-shafted air on errands of their own or perched on outcrops of rock. High in the domed roof of the cavern, scores of others hung from huge rings, their wings wrapped bat-like around their bodies. There were men up there, too. Rincewind swallowed hard when he saw them, because they were walking on that broad expanse of ceiling like flies. Then he made out the thousands of tiny rings that studded the ceiling. A number of inverted men were watching Psepha's flight with interest. Rincewind swallowed again. For the life of him, he couldn't think of what to do next.
"Well?" he asked in a whisper. "Any suggestions?"
"Obviously you attack," said Kring scornfully.
"Why didn't I think of that?" said Rincewind. "Could it be because they all have crossbows?"
"You're a defeatist."
"Defeatist? That's because I'm going to be defeated."
"You're your own worst enemy, Rincewind," said the sword.
Rincewind looked up at grinning men. "Bet," he said wearily. Before Kring could reply, Psepha reared in mid-air and alighted on one of the large rings, which rocked alarmingly.
"Would you like to die now or surrender first?"
asked Kali Sadra calmly. Men were converging on the ring from all directions, walking with a swaying motion as their hooked boots engaged the ceiling rings. There were more boots on a rack that hung in a small platform built on the side of the perch ring. Before Rincewind could stop him, the dragon rider had leapt from the creature's back to land on the platform, where he stood grinning at the wizard's discomfiture. There was a small expressive sound made by a number of crossbows being cocked. Rincewind looked up at a number of impassive, upside-down faces. The dragonfolk's taste in clothing didn't run to anything much more imaginative than a leather harness studded with bronze ornaments. Knives and sword sheaths were worn inverted. Those who were not wearing helmets let their hair flow freely, so that it moved like seaweed in the ventilation breeze near the roof. There were several women among them. The inversion did strange things to their anatomy. Rincewind stared.
"Surrender,"
said Kali Sadra again. Rincewind opened his mouth to do so. Kring hummed a warning, and agonizing waves of pain shot up his arm.
"Never," he squeaked. The pain stopped.
"Of course he won't,"
boomed an expansive voice behind him.
"He's a hero, isn't he?"
Rincewind turned and looked into a pair of hairy nostrils. They belonged to a heavily built young man, hanging nonchalantly from the ceiling by his boots.
"What is your name, hero?"
said the man.
"So that we know who you were."
Agony shot up Rincewind's arm.
I'm Rincewind of Ankh," he managed to gasp.
"And I am Dragonlord,"
said the hanging man, pronouncing the word with the harsh click in the back of the throat that Rincewind could only think of as a kind of integral punctuation.
"You have come to challenge me in mortal combat."
"Well, no, I didn't."
"You are mistaken, Kali Sadra. Help our hero into a pair of hook boots. I am sure he is anxious to get started."
"No, look, I came here to find my friends. I'm sure there's really no..."
Rincewind began as the dragon rider guided him firmly onto the platform, pushed him onto a seat, and proceeded to strap hook boots to his feet.
"Hurry up, Kali Sadra. We mustn't keep our hero from his destiny,"
said Leo. "Look, I expect my friends are happy enough here, so if you could just, set me down somewhere..."
"You will see your friends soon enough,"
said the Dragon Lord airily.
"If you are religious, I mean. None who enter the Wyrmberg ever leave again, except metaphorically, of course. Show him how to reach the rings, Kali Sadra."
"Look what you've got me into," Rincewind hissed.
Kring vibrated in his hand.
"Remember that I am a magic sword," it hummed.
"How can I forget?"
"Climb the ladder and grab a ring,"
said the dragon rider.
"Then bring your feet up until the hooks catch."
He helped the protesting wizard climb until he was hanging upside down, robe tucked into his breeches, Kring dangling from one hand. At this angle, the dragonfolk looked reasonably bearable, but the dragons themselves, hanging from their perches, loomed over the scene like immense gargoyles. Their eyes glowed with interest.
"Attention, please,"
said Leo. A dragon rider handed him a long shape wrapped in red silk.
"We fight to the death," he said. "Yours."
"And I suppose I earn my freedom if I win," said Rincewind without much hope. Leo Rt indicated the assembled dragon riders with a tilt of his head.
"Don't be naive," he said.
Rincewind took a deep breath. "I suppose I should warn you," he said, his voice hardly quavering at all, "that this is a magic sword."
Leo Rt let the red silk wrapping drop away into the gloom and flourished a jet-black blade. Runes glowed on its surface.
"What a coincidence,"
he said, and lunged. Rincewind went rigid with fright, but his arm swung out as Kring shot forward. The swords met in an explosion of octarine light.
Leo Rt swung himself backwards, his eyes narrowing.
Kring leapt past his guard, and although the Dragon Lord's sword jerked up to deflect most of the force, the result was a thin red line across its master's torso. With a growl, he launched himself at the wizard, boots clattering as he slid from ring to ring. The swords met again in another violent discharge of magic, and at the same time, Leo Rt brought his other hand down against Rincewind's head, jarring him so hard that one foot jerked out of its ring and flailed desperately. Rincewind knew himself to be almost certainly the worst wizard on the Discworld, since he knew but one spell. Yet for all that, he was still a wizard. And thus, by the inexorable laws of magic, this meant that upon his demise, it would be Death himself who appeared to claim him, instead of sending one of his numerous servants, as is usually the case. Thus it was that, as a grinning Leo Rt swung back and brought his sword around in a lazy arc, time ran into treacle. To Rincewind's eyes, the world was suddenly lit by a flickering octarine light, tinged with violet, as photons impacted on the sudden magical aura. Inside it, the Dragon Lord was a ghastly huge statue, his sword moving at a snail's pace in the glow. Beside Leo Rt was another figure, visible only to those who can see in the extra four dimensions of magic. It was tall and dark and thin, and against a sudden night of frosty stars, it swung two-handed, a scythe of proverbial sharpness. Rincewind ducked. The blade hissed coldly through the air beside his head, and entered the rock of the cavern roof without slowing. Death screamed a curse in his cold, crypt voice. The scene vanished. What passed for reality on the Discworld reasserted itself with a rush of sound. Leo Rt gasped at the sudden turn of speed with which the wizard had dodged his killing stroke, and with that desperation only available to the really terrified, Rincewind uncoiled like a snake and launched himself across the space between them. He locked both hands around the Dragon Lord's sword arm and wrenched. It was at that moment that Rincewind's one remaining ring, already overburdened, slid out of the rock with a nasty little metal sound. He plunged down, swung wildly, and ended up dangling over a bone-splintering Death, with his hands gripping the Dragon Lord's arm so tightly that the man screamed. Leo Rt looked up at his feet. Small flakes of rock were dropping out of the roof around the ring pitons.
"Let go, damn you!" he screamed. "Or we'll both die!"
Rincewind said nothing. He was concentrating on maintaining his grip and keeping his mind closed to the pressing images of his fate on the rocks below.
"Shoot him!"
bellowed Leo Rt. Out of the corner of his eye, Rincewind saw several crossbows levelled at him. Leo Rt chose that moment to flail down with his free hand, and a fistful of rings stabbed into the wizard's fingers. He let go. Two-Flower grabbed the bars and pulled himself up.
"Say anything?"
said Hrun from the region of his feet.
"Just clouds."
Hrun lifted him down again and sat on the edge of one of the wooden beds that were the only furnishings in the cell.
"Bloody hell," he said.
"Don't despair," said Two-Flower.
"I'm not despairing."
"I expect it's all some sort of misunderstanding. I expect they'll release us soon. They seem very civilized."
Hrun stared at him from under bushy eyebrows. He started to say something, then appeared to think better of it. He sighed instead.
"And when we get back, we can say we've seen dragons," Two-Flower continued. "What about that, eh?"
"Dragons don't exist,"
said Hrun flatly.
"Codis of Chimeria killed the last one 200 years ago. I don't know what we're seeing, but they aren't dragons."
"But they carried us up in the air. In that hall there must have been hundreds."
"I expect it was just magic," said Hrun dismissively.
"Well, they look like dragons," said Two-Flower, an air of defiance about him. I always wanted to see dragons, ever since I was a little lad. Dragons flying around in the sky, breathing flames.
They just used to crawl around in swamps and stuff, and all they breathed was stink,
said Hurun, lying down in the bunk.
They weren't very big either. They used to collect firewood.
I heard they used to collect treasure, said Twoflower.
And firewood.
Hey,
Hurun added, brightening up,
did you notice all those rooms they brought us through? Pretty impressive, I thought. Lot of good stuff about. Plus some of those tapestries have got to be worth a fortune.
He scratched his chin thoughtfully, making a noise like a porcupine shouldering its way through gorse.
What happens next?
Asked Twoflower. Hurun screwed a finger in his ear and inspected it absently.
Oh, he said, I expect in a minute the door will be flung back and I'll be dragged off to some sort of temple arena where I'll fight maybe a couple of giant spiders and an 8-foot slave from the jungles of Klatch. And then I'll rescue some kind of a princess from the altar and then kill off a few guards or whatever. And then this girl will show me the secret passage out of the place and we'll liberate a couple of horses and escape with the treasure.
Hurun leaned his head back on his hands and looked at the ceiling, whistling tunelessly.
All that? Said Twoflower.
Usually.
Twoflower sat down on his bunk and tried to think. This proved difficult because his mind was awash with dragons.
Dragons.
Ever since he was 2 years old, he'd been captivated by the pictures of the fiery beasts in the Octarine fairy book. His sister had told him they didn't really exist, and he recalled the bitter disappointment. If the world didn't contain those beautiful creatures, he decided, it wasn't half the world it ought to be. And then later, he had been bound apprentice to Nine Reeds the Master Account, who in his grey-mindedness was everything that dragons were not, and there was no time for dreaming. But there was something wrong with these dragons. They were too small and sleek compared to the ones in his mind's eye. Dragons ought to be big and green, and clawed, and exotic, and fire-breathing. Big and green, with long, sharp... Something moved at the edge of his vision. In the furthest, darkest corner of the dungeon. When he turned his head, it vanished, although he thought he heard the faintest of noises that might have been made by claws scrabbling on stone. Hurun, he said. There was a snore from the other bunk. Twoflower padded over to the corner, poking gingerly at the stones in case there was a secret panel. At that moment, the door was flung back, thumping against the wall. Half a dozen guards hurtled through it, spread out and flung themselves down on one knee. Their weapons were aimed exclusively at Hurun. When he thought about this later, Twoflower felt quite offended. Hurun snored. A woman strode into the room. Not many women can stride convincingly, but she managed it. She glanced briefly at Twoflower, as one might look at a piece of furniture, then glared down at the man on the bed. She was wearing the same sort of leather harness that the dragon riders had been wearing, but in her case it was much briefer. That and the magnificent mane of chestnut red hair that fell to her waist was her only concession to what even on the Discworld passed for decency. She was also wearing a thoughtful expression. Hurun made a glubbing noise, turned over, and slept on. With a careful movement, as though handling some instrument of rare delicacy, the woman drew a slim black dagger from her belt and stabbed downwards. Before it was halfway through its arc, Harun's right hand moved so fast that it appeared to travel between 2 points in space without any time occupying the intervening air. It closed around the woman's wrist with a dull smack. His other hand groped feverishly for a sword that wasn't there. Hurun awoke.
"Hmm?"
he said, looking up at the woman with a puzzled frown. Then he caught sight of the bowmen.
"Let go,"
said the woman in a voice that was calm and quiet and edged with diamonds. Hurun released his grip slowly. She stepped back, massaging her wrist, and looking at Hurun in much the same way that a cat watches a mouse hole.
"So," she said at last, "you passed the first test. What is your name, barbarian?"
"Who are you calling a barbarian?"
snarled Hurun.
"That is what I want to know."
Hurun counted the bowmen slowly and made a brief calculation. His shoulders relaxed.
"I am Hurun of Chimeria. And you?"
"Liesa, Dragon Lady."
"You are the lord of this place?"
"That remains to be seen. You have the look about you of a hired sword, Hurun of Chimeria. I could use you, if you pass the tests, of course. There are 3 of them. You have passed the first."
What are the other... Harun paused, his lips moved soundlessly, and then he hazarded, two.
Perilous. And the fee? Valuable.
Excuse me, said Two Flower.
And if I fail these tests, said Harun, ignoring him.
The air between Harun and Liesa crackled with small explosions of charisma as their gazes sought for a hold.
If you had failed the first test, you would now be dead. This may be considered a typical penalty.
Look, began Two Flower. Liesa spared him a brief glance and appeared actually to notice him for the first time.
Take that away, she said calmly, and turned back to Harun.
Two of the guards shouldered their bows, grasped Two Flower by the elbows, and lifted him off the ground. Then they trotted smartly through the doorway.
"Hey!"
said Two Flower, as they hurried down the corridor outside.
"Where?"
as they stopped in front of another door.
"Is my..."
as they dragged the door open.
"Luggage!"
He landed in a heap of what once might have been straw. The door banged shut, its echoes punctuated by the sound of bolts being slammed home. In the other cell, Harun had barely blinked.
"Okay," he said. "What is the second test?"
"You must kill my two brothers."
Harun considered this.
"Both at the same time, or one after the other?" he said.
"Consecutively or concurrently," she assured him.
"What?"
"Just kill them," she said sharply.
"Good fighters, are they?"
"Renowned."
"So in return for all this?"
"You will wed me and become Lord of the Wyrmberg."
There was a long pause. Harun's eyebrows twisted themselves in unaccustomed calculation.
"I get you and this mountain," he said at last.
"Yes."
She looked him squarely in the eye, and her lips twitched.
"The fee is worthwhile, I assure you."
Harun dropped his gaze to the rings on her hand. The stones were large, being the incredibly rare blue milk diamonds from the clay basins of Mythos. When he managed to turn his eye from them, he saw Liesa glaring down at him in fury.
"So calculating," she rasped. "Harun the barbarian, who would boldly walk into the jaws of death himself?"
Harun shrugged.
"Sure," he said. "The only reason for walking into the jaws of death is so you can steal his gold teeth."
He brought one arm around expansively, and the wooden bunk was at the end of it. It cannoned into the bowman, and Harun followed it joyously, felling one man with a blow and snatching the weapon from another. A moment later it was all over. Liesa had not moved.
"Well?" she said.
"Well what?" said Harun from the carnage.
"Do you intend to kill me?"
"What? Oh, no. No, this is just, you know, kind of a habit. Just keeping in practice. So where are these brothers?" he grinned.
Two Flower sat on his straw and stared into the darkness. He wondered how long he had been there. Hours at least. Days, probably. He speculated that perhaps it had been years, and he had simply forgotten. No, that sort of thinking wouldn't do. He tried to think of something else. Grass, trees, fresh air, dragons. Dragons. There was the faintest of scrabblings in the darkness. Two Flower felt the sweat prickle on his forehead. Something was in the cell with him, something that made small noises, but even in the pitch blackness gave the impression of hugeness. He felt the air move. When he lifted his arm, there was the greasy feel and faint shower of sparks that betokened a localized magical field. Two Flower found himself fervently wishing for light. A gout of flame rolled past his head and struck the far wall. As the rocks flashed into furnace heat, he looked up at the dragon that now occupied more than half the cell.
"I obey, Lord," said a voice in his head.
By the glow of the crackling, spitting stone, Two Flower looked into his own reflection in two enormous green eyes. Beyond them, the dragon was as multi-hued, horned, spiked, and lithe as the one in his memory. A real dragon. Its folded wings were nevertheless still wide enough to scrape the wall on both sides of the room. It lay with him between its talons.
Obey, he said, his voice vibrating with terror and delight.
Of course, Lord.
The glow faded away. Twoflower pointed a trembling finger at where he remembered the door to be, and said, "Open it." The dragon raised its huge head. Again the ball of flame rolled out, but this time, as the dragon's neck muscles contracted, its colour faded from orange to yellow, from yellow to white, and finally to the faintest of blues. By that time the flame was also very thin, and where it touched the wall the molten rock spat and ran. When it reached the door, the metal exploded into a shower of hot droplets. Black shadows arced and jiggered over the walls. The metal bubbled for an eye-aching moment, and then the door fell in two pieces in the passage beyond. The flame winked out with a suddenness that was almost as startling as its arrival. Twoflower stepped gingerly over the cooling door and looked up and down the corridor. It was empty. The dragon followed. The heavy door frame caused it some minor difficulty, which it overcame with a swing of its shoulders that tore the timber out and tossed it to one side. The creature looked expectantly at Twoflower, its skin rippling and twitching as it sought to open its wings in the confines of the passage. "How did you get in there?" said Twoflower.
"You summoned me, master."
"I don't remember doing that."
"In your mind. You called me up in your mind,"
thought the dragon patiently. "You mean I just thought of you, and there you were?"
"Yes."
"It was magic?"
"Yes."
"But I've thought about dragons all my life."
"In this place, the frontier between thought and reality is probably a little confused. All I know is that once I was not, and then you thought me, and then I was. Therefore, of course, I am yours to command."
"Good grief!" Half a dozen guards chose that moment to turn the bend in the corridor. They stopped, open-mouthed. Then one remembered himself sufficiently to raise his crossbow and fire. The dragon's chest heaved. The quarrel exploded into flaming fragments in mid-air. The guards scurried out of sight. A fraction of a second later, a wash of flame played over the stones where they'd been standing. Twoflower looked up in admiration. "Can you fly, too?" he said.
"Of course."
Twoflower glanced up and down the corridor and decided against following the guards. Since he knew himself to be totally lost already, any direction was probably an improvement. He edged past the dragon and hurried away, the huge beast turning with difficulty to follow him. They padded down a series of passages that crisscrossed like a maze. At one point, Twoflower thought he heard shouts a long way behind him, but they soon faded away. Sometimes the dark arch of a crumbling doorway loomed past them in the gloom. Light filtered through dimly from various shafts, and here and there bounced off big mirrors that had been mortared into the angles of the passage. Sometimes there was a brighter glow from a distant light well. What was odd, thought Twoflower, as he strolled down a wide flight of stairs and kicked up billowing clouds of silver dust motes, was that the tunnels here were much wider, and better constructed too. There were statues in niches set in the walls, and here and there faded but interesting tapestries had been hung. They mainly showed dragons by the hundred, in flight, or hanging from their perch rings, dragons with men on their backs, hunting down deer, and sometimes other men. Twoflower touched one tapestry gingerly. The fabric crumbled instantly in the hot, dry air, leaving only a dangling mesh where some threads had been plaited with fine gold wire. "I wonder why they left all this," he said.
"I don't know,"
said a polite voice in his head. He turned up and looked into the scaly, hoarse face above him. "What is your name, dragon?" said Twoflower.
"I don't know."
"I think I shall call you Nine Reeds."
"That is my name, then,"